Accession number 22155, Reel 2.
There was the Chicago 1960.
Martin Bell, Reel 2.
Was the
So what was the situation in Northern Ireland when you went?
It was playing off a lot of events elsewhere in the world. 1968 was an amazing year for news. You had the sort of revolution in you had the streets of Paris. There was the Chicago Democratic Convention. There was a lot of civil rights awareness in the air. I went to America for the first time in 68. I found cities in flames. It was the year of the murder of Martin Luther King, which was April 68. And I went to Chicago completely in flames, to Wilmington, Delaware, completely in flames. There were tanks on the lawn of the White House. And it was a sort of a watershed year for a lot of things. And Paris was also influential. Prague was influential. And the nationalists, or let's just say the Roman Catholic community in Northern Ireland, some of them said, look, this is our chance. Enough with the old nationalism or the IRA. We want equal opportunities for jobs and so on and so on. And it became a civil rights campaign. And it was led in Londonderry by John Hume and Ivan Cooper, who was a Protestant. And they led a march against the forces of law and order, represented, I think, by the B Specials, who were reserve policemen, and there were some bloodied heads in that. And I think we're talking about towards the end of 68. I first came on the scene in December 68, when John Hume and others were before the magistrates on charges of breaching the peace and so on. So I got into that, and there was a civil rights march in early the next year, which culminated in a brutal ambush in a place called Burntollet Bridge. And there was still the old Protestant rule in Northern Ireland. It was Stormont ruled. And it bubbled and bubbled and bubbled. And it was the nearest to a civil war in my country I would ever report. And, of course, the presence of metropolitan reporters reporting impartially and dispassionately caused huge offence with the older style members of the loyalist majority. After all, it's the BBC, it's the British Broadcasting Corporation, isn't it? Why were we giving all this airtime to rebels and Fenians and so on and so on and so on? So I really got to be very careful about what I said and how I said it. But I don't think I got anything too wrong. But I encountered an enormous amount of hostility. I mean, they attempted to hold a civil rights meeting in Limavady, which was the hardcore prod area of County Londonderry, and I had to flee for my life. I sort of locked myself in the loo and got out of the window and escaped over a ploughed field. I mean, it was the heavy boys were moving in on me because by that time my face was getting dangerously well known. But I worked at it. We were there when the Belfast went up in flames in August 69. It's one of the great misses of my journalistic career. I'd been on the streets for 48 hours. And I was so exhausted, I just slept through a lot of it all. Woke up in the morning to discover I'd missed it, you know. However, and it was also an experience of BBC censorship, the first time I really felt it. I wrote about this because what actually happened in Belfast was the Catholics were burned out of their homes by the Protestants. There's no doubt about it. It happened along the full Shankill division. I was not allowed in the report that followed, reporting. I mean, the Catholics then came back to pick up their possessions. I wasn't allowed in the reporting to say who were Catholics and who were Protestants, because that would inflame the situation. We had a man called Waldo Maguire who was an old hand, and he just didn't want to be held responsible for. But in fact, I think we exacerbated it by pulling our punches. So all I could show was this woman wheeling her pram with its possessions, and on top of the possessions was a crucifix. Well, that said which side she came from, but you know, we should have been. I was upset at being censored, and I should have made a stand, but I was too green, I suppose, and probably too unsure of myself and too open to persuasion by these people that if I'd said what had happened, I'd caused fresh riots that night. So that was a mistake on my part. I don't think I'd have had the power to correct it, but I remember being told that I wasn't allowed to write the script as I wished to write it. But I learned a lot, and that bubbled along right up until Direct Rule, which was, I think, imposed in August 69, troops on the streets, cups of tea from the Catholic population, and that lasted several months before it all turned sour. Tremendous loss of life. In 73, I did my first panorama. It was called 5 Years, 1,000 Deaths. You know, 1,000 people had died violently in a part of the United Kingdom in those 5 years. And, you know, the average rate, 200-300 a year, was pretty strong. Tremendous gun battles.
Are there any particular incidents you recall very vividly?
A few. One was there was a terrific battle involving Protestants and the 3rd Light Infantry British Army in the Shankill Road in October the 11th, 1969. I was caught in the middle of that. That was scary. And the other was the Battle of Leonardoon Avenue, which was when there were some disputed houses that the Catholics, led by the IRA, were trying to move into, and they were stopped by the British Army in Leonardoon Avenue, July 1972, and a terrific gun battle broke out then. It was all made for very vivid television, but you know, I was lucky to stay alive then as well, because we didn't have any body armor or anything in those days. No armed vehicles, nothing. You were just. But it was, there'd be some incidents like that, and it just went on so long, and it seemed so endless. But it was very good training for a young reporter. It trained me how to write fast. It trained me about accuracy, because one mistake, the consequences could be so damaging. So I learned responsibility early on, but I hope I didn't allow censorship again to distort what I wanted to say. The reports were mostly very short, and they mostly disappeared because they don't exist in the form that our videotape reports do, with the sound and the picture available in the archive. Because what happened was you put your, say, 2 minutes of vivid footage on the telecine, the projection machine. Somebody would run it in Belfast, often live into the news program, and you would sit in front of this in the studio, in front of an open microphone, just voice it as it went out. So it didn't exist in any, and I don't think any of those things exist anymore, except if there's a few fragments. But they were pretty vivid, and they caused no end of bother. I remember that.
What sort of cooperation did you have with the Belfast end of the BBC?
It came and went. I do remember the engineers getting very upset about one of my reports. Well, it's not their business. I mean, their job is to press the buttons. You know, how did I know that such a shot came from a Catholic area or a Protestant area or whatever? We were very lucky. We had two inspired local news editors, one of whom, Robin Walsh, later joined us from Ulster Television and later went on to be the BBC's controller in Northern Ireland. And they more or less prevented. There was a slight orange faction in the newsroom, but they leant very hard on that. And we were able, I think, to present the news fairly impartially. There were these old-style prods who, of course, the BBC was run by Protestants. It had an outside broadcast on the Parade of the 12th. had one or two token Catholics at the time I joined, but it was a Protestant newsroom, working hand in glove with a Protestant government. But the individual, Cecil Taylor, was the first news editor I worked with. These are local people, and Robin Walsh the second, they put their news principles first. And I think on the whole, the record was fairly honourable. Good cameramen too, local ones, took enormous risks.
Did that balance change, you know, the Protestant-Catholic balance in the newsroom?
Yes, it did. I mean, it did, and the hard-line orange element, which is always very small, was eventually ended. And I think it's... I don't think anybody asks too much which community you come from these days so much anymore. But it was an issue at the time.
Why are the marches, the orange marches, so provocative?
They're only provocative when they go into areas which are then inhabited by the other side. And of course, demographically, these things change. I don't remember in all the time I was there, I don't remember the Gavachi Road was an issue at all. There was an issue when the Shankill people marched down by a block of flats, which was mainly inhabited by Catholics, and that was always a tension, point of tension. But I don't think that the marches as such were provocative. It's simply a question of where they went. I mean, they could march around in their own areas as much as they wanted, have these huge bonfires. In fact, I liked it. I mean, they had a sense of who they were. They had a sense of history, where they came from. They had wonderful music on both sides. I mean, where did James Galway learn his art? He learned it in a flute band on the Protestant side in Belfast. I see nothing wrong with the music, the marching, any of that. But it is when it is done to provoke the other side, then it gets difficult.
Would you have been there at the time of Bernadette Devlin, when she was very prominent?
I was. She certainly took part in the long march to which I referred. It was called People's Democracy. And I think the idea was a march from Belfast to Londonderry. They did a few miles every day, and she was certainly involved in that prominently. And they'd all got ambushed at Burntollet Bridge near Clawdy. And I remember it's an interestingly how history can be rewritten, because it's gone into legend that the police led them into the ambush, which is Burntollet is a narrow defile, even narrow in those days before they widened the road. And the farmers came across the up from the, they threw things at the marchers, and a few bloodied heads and so on. And the legend was created that the police led them into it. Well, I was there in Clawdy when the police superintendent was pleading with them not to go ahead with the march. He said, "We can't guarantee your safety. We know there's trouble ahead. Please call it off." And they wouldn't. But, you know, 20, 30 years later, they try to rewrite the history. I was there, and I know it wasn't like that. In fact, I was interviewed by an old hand of the Belfast Telegraph, and he was also there. And years later, we talked about it, and we was amazed at the way the history had been reinvented.
Was it difficult explaining to a British audience the complexity of Northern Ireland?
Yes, it was difficult understanding it. It was especially difficult, I suppose, in the short time frames allowed to you in television news. But, I mean, no more difficult than trying to... In fact, easier than trying to explain the complexity of Bosnia 30 years on. Well, 20 years on, 25 years on. When you'd have five different armies fighting for the same patch of turf in some cases. It was easier than that. And you could assume a degree of knowledge in the populace at large. You didn't have to do everything in shorthand. But of course, people would be very quick to take offence. It was very easy. I mean, that's why I suppose, inevitably, as a journalist, you'll get some poison pen letter. And I suppose I got my first hate mail then. There were certainly some people in Dungannon, some Protestants, who vowed to send me home in a box and wrote to tell me so. And I think the BBC withdrew me for a little while after that, but I came back in again because you mustn't be intimidated. You know, you get intimidated by everybody. I got quite well in with the UDA, the Ulster Defence Association, who were a main force in the protest marches against the first attempt at power sharing they brought the government down, the first power sharing government down, led by Brian Faulkner. They brought it down in 1974. I think probably the London government capitulated, but I was very well connected on the loyalist side at that time, which I had to be, had to be.
Was that side a very mixed side? You know, you were saying about your connection with the UDA. One hears of the Shankill Butchers, for instance.
Well, the UDA was a new force. It was led by a man called Andy Tyrry, with whom I got on very well. And I think they rather liked the publicity. They would go out and hold sort of secret marches at night, and they liked to have a camera there because it showed they were important. So it was there was a trade-off there. But anything involving arms, I would stay away from. I think the IRA was always a bit suspicious of me. I got on very well with the nationalist leaders like John Hume, Ivan Cooper, and others. This is all, as I remember, it was even before Gerry Adams, though I certainly did meet Martin McGuinness way back in about 1970 in Derry. Stroke City, they called it. That was another great thing. Do we call it Derry or Londonderry? Well, the house style was, if you called it Londonderry initially, you could call it Derry after that. I heard a talk show host, because he was saying Londonderry, Stroke Derry. He just called it Stroke City. If you say Stroke City, anybody in Northern Ireland will know what you mean.
Did you have to be very careful about language?
Very careful. I learned that very early on. I once made a reference to the six counties. Well, there are six counties in Northern Ireland, but there are more than six counties in Ulster. And six counties is actually a term used by the Republican side, so I was warned off not to use it. It's an emotive term. Yes, you have to be very, very careful. And, terrorists, guerrillas, gunmen, you can get yourself into a terrible mess. You start not thinking, and then you find, sometimes you listen to somebody's broadcast, and you find he's talking about armed gunmen. Well, what's an unarmed gunman,
These peace walls between the communities, did they go up gradually during your in-and-out time there?
Yeah, the police would put up. They weren't there when I left. What would happen was that the police, or the army actually, army engineers, would put up huge structures covered with no more than sacking, like screens. So, shall we say, the March of the 12th could go past the flashpoint and wouldn't actually be seen by the nationalists on the other. They'd be heard, it wouldn't be seen. That was the beginning of it, but because of those attacks in 69, in the summer of 69, it wasn't a peace line or anything, it was just militant Protestants attacking Catholics in their homes and burning them out. Those were cross streets between Catholic and Protestant, and walls went up between them. And later, as the city developed, the motorway was built, really, to keep the two sides apart. But in the early days, they were much more intermingled, of course.
So you would have been in and out, would you, Martin?
All the time. I had a policy of not waiting for the news to come to me. I was very driven young man, and I ran every night. I'd do patrols, looking for trouble, if you like, because it's no good just getting the police accounts the next morning. I remember running into Lord Carrington once outside a police station on the Shankill Road. He was then Defence Secretary, and his minders were very upset that I'd been tipped off that I knew where he was going to be. But in fact, I just patrolled till I found the old chap. Well, he was a young chap then. And that got the police press off, the army press office, into terrible trouble, because it was assumed that they tipped me off. Well, they hadn't. I just worked until I found him.
So you were very proactive in searching out.
I was very competitive, like I suppose most journalists. I didn't like to be beaten. I liked to win. And because there were only two sides, every day you'd win or you'd lose or you'd draw. There was no, and you knew your editors had the two sets in there, so they were making comparisons. So there was competitive, yeah.
It was interesting you talking about censorship earlier on and how you stood up to this. But did you find that there was this sort of good taste aspect. There were things that you perhaps, even if you filmed them, would not be shown.
No, in fact, I didn't stand up to it. The first instance I gave you in August 69 was a capitulation on my part. No, the good taste censorship didn't come in till much later. It was a later phenomenon. I think it came in with videotape, with the immediacy of getting the stuff on the air, almost as it happens. And it never bothered me much until the early 90s. I don't remember having any serious troubles with it in the 60s and 70s.
Did you go after human stories? Because I know later on this was very important to you, wasn't it? To get the human side of conflict.
Not as much as I would have done if I'd known then what I know now. I was too much, too close to my own military career, brief as it was. I probably spent too much time hanging out with the British Army. They would go on surround and search operations in nationalist communities, and we'd go with them, and we'd get into terrible trouble. I remember one of the nationalist sections of Armagh. It was the Gordon Highlanders. They went in, they invited us along, and it was they were very, like all the soldiers then, I mean, they were under the counter-terrorist doctrine devised by Frank Kitson, who had learned it in Malaya and, I think, Kenya. And if you look at the way the British Army was acting in those early years, it's very colonial, you know, you put somebody up against the wall and frisk them and so on. It was quite tough. And inevitably, the Gordon Highlanders would go into this housing estate. There'd be some bruised people afterwards. Came the dawn, the bruised people would see the cameras there and say, look what they did to us. And suddenly, the army doesn't like you anymore because you are the sounding board for the distressed people of the nationalist community. So you end up, first of all, you're accused by the nationalists being lackeys and flunkies of the British Army. And then you find yourself being accused by the British Army of giving them bad publicity and accusing them of brutality. So it wasn't easy. It wasn't easy.
Neutral.
I think so. I think I would like to say I was always on the side of the innocent and those who suffered. I don't remember being more sympathetic to one community than to the other. You were immensely sympathetic to those who were driven out of their homes, whatever their religious affiliation or whatever part of the city they come from. But I suppose I was, and I maintained my links with the British Army. I mean, it was a, apart from anything else, they were a good source of news. And if you found a colourful major, you'd put him on television a lot until the colourful major's colonel told him to stop. They were always afraid they were going to get a new Mad Mitch, you know, Colonel Colin Mitchell of the Argyles, who was about the great hero of the television hero of the army in Aden, classic neo-colonial operation. And the War Office did not like it. He saved his regiment and lost his job, very much like Bob Stewart a generation later.
And so did you meet him, Mad Mitch?
Did I? No, I wasn't in Aden. I may have met him once since, but he was not, I'm pretty sure he was not active in Northern Ireland. I think Aden was his last hurrah. I didn't do Aden except after independence. I went there once, so it was not. Michael Blakey would be the man you need for that. He was there a lot.
When were you last covering Northern Ireland?
I suppose just before I became diplomatic correspondent in early 1977, or probably 1976 was the last time. I went there more occasionally, latterly, because they staffed it more from Belfast.
So you were there during the really violent years?
I would say I was there for the first 7 years or so of the reignition of the Troubles, yes.
But I understand not Bloody Sunday.
Not Bloody Sunday. I wasn't even in Northern Ireland that day. That was the reporter there was Peter Stewart, who is now deceased, I think. Apart from me, I was very much the exception. The BBC recruited, both BBC and ITN would recruit against the grain of their institutions. That is, the BBC felt itself to be too effete, upmarket, and so it would recruit the sharper characters from the tabloid end of Fleet Street. Peter Stewart was one, Michael Blakey was another, Keith Graves, both of the Express. Those were the people we recruited. The people ITN recruited tended to sound as if they come straight out of an officer's mess, as some of them had. I mean, they thought they needed a touch of class, and so they tended to have the posher accents. Michael Nicholson, Gerald Seymour, they had a diplomatic correspondent who came straight out of an officer's mess. I mean, Peter Snow was a classic ITN man, long before he joined the BBC. That's whom they liked. It was an interesting, cultural switch.
And it was just the two main groups at that time. Wasn't
there anybody else? Nobody else was even in the frame until, I suppose, TVAM came along with a pretty vestigial news operation. Really until Sky News started, which I suppose was late 80s, early 90s. And then you'd start to get people from GMTV and so on. And a huge explosion in the BBC's news gathering, which was actually, which I regret. We would commit far too many reporters to anything that moved. I mean, it reached its nadir or apex, I don't know which you'd call it, in the ground operation in Kosovo in June 1999, which nearly 3,000 journalists followed NATO. They're completely mad. BBC had, I think, 19 reporters on the ground. 19. Of course, we were always better when we worked in small groups. This is why our Bosnia operation worked so well for us. There were very few of us. And we kind of loved each other and we did the business. But as soon as you start this internal competition, I mean, in Northern Ireland in the old days, there'd be one chap doing radio and one doing television. Unless the thing was absolutely flaring up in both Derry and Belfast, in which case you'd have two.
Your team, was it really important to have the right cameraman?
Absolutely.
And was it in the early days, did you also have to have a sound recordist?
Yes, we did. Initially, we had a lighting man as well. I mean, this was union rules and institutional habits. And that didn't really go out until it went out over severe union opposition with the advent of videotape at about 1982. And it started, we lost the lighting man by then. Sorry.
But when you first went into the foreign field, there were very few of you. Is that right? Very few foreign journalists.
Yes. It was a different era. In those days, there were only two, we're talking in British terms, there were only two television networks working to a pretty shared common agenda. We both felt we knew what news was. Later they diverged. At that time, the down-market papers, the tabloids, the Mirror, the Express, Mail, they would have correspondents in the field and photographers travelling with them. So there'd be a much heavier print presence than there was later. And what happened as the years went by was that the print presence diminished. The tabloids more or less ceased to cover foreign news, except for royalty abroad. I mean, Diana had to move abroad, you can imagine, or football. In fact, there was a famous occasion where a riot in Warsaw against the communist regime was reported all by the football writers who moved from the back page to the front. And were amazed to discover how liberal the front editors were with their travelling expenses. But of course, as the years passed, television became more important. The television news agencies became more powerful and had money to throw around, hired a lot of camera crews. Television itself became more portable. We're now in the age of videotape, and by the mid-80s, really, we were in the age of satellite as well. Then you get satellite trucks, portable dishes, the whole paraphernalia, which actually I welcomed because it gave me, as a professional in the field, a vast amount of freedom. In the old days, from Biafra to Vietnam to the 67 Arab-Israeli war, film would be sent home in packages, in aircraft, with a soundtrack. And when it reached London, it would be processed and edited, the pictures set against the soundtrack, a fiddly process. But it also meant that if the editors wanted to fiddle around with the report, take this out, substitute the middle for the end or something. They had the freedom to do it, which I found immensely depressing. Whereas when the satellites came along, we edited in the field, close to where the action had been. You put it on the satellite. You negotiate lengths with London, but they can either... It only would arrive there 10 minutes before the programme. They had no choice but to run it or to drop it. They couldn't change it.